So hello everybody.
Hi.
Hi, happy Saturday. Happy April Fool's Day.
Right? That's right.
Yes. Okay, so if everybody can get a little settled, get a little ready. I am super excited. Hello. Shh. One, two, three. If you got eyes, put them on me. La la la. All right. All right, everybody, I am so happy to be here to introduce today my friends from the Department of Rehabilitation. I'm very fortunate that myself and Chris Fendrick and Mitch Pomerantz in the past, we got our very own Margaret Bookman Garcia as well. We get to work alongside these folks here at DOR on the Blind Advisory Committee. And so I'm first going to hand off to the Director of Department of Rehabilitation, Joe Xavier.
All right, thank you, Sarah. Can you guys hear me okay? All right, cool. So first of all, just good morning to everyone here in the room and on Zoom land, wherever that address may be around the state and or the country if you're joining in. Just want to start by just telling you it's an honor to be here today. I've come to these conventions. My wife is asking me how long, and I said, I don't know, 30, 40 years or so in various capacities. So very happy to be here. And CCB leadership, Sarah and Gabe and the rest of the folks, thank you for the work that you do and continue to lead the organization. We need folks to step up in leadership today more than ever before. And I sat in on the membership committee and heard about succession planning. That's real, folks. At all levels, in all organizations, including government, we have a number of our staff that are here. So want to acknowledge them. At the table with me today, we have Sue Pelbath, our Specialized Services Deputy, Peter Dawson, our Region Director, and Laura Rasmussen, our District Administrator. You'll be hearing from them later on in the agenda. So more to come on that front. And then certainly yesterday we had, for those of you that celebrated Cesar Chavez Day, just want to acknowledge that. The other thing I wanted to share with you is if you have not been tracking, the governor appointed Victor Duran as our chief deputy director. Victor was appointed back in December, joined us in the middle of January. Very, very happy to have him joining our executive team and joining me in leading this organization along with the rest of the executive team as we go through the times that we are in these days. One of the things that I think I always remind the audiences of is that when we come here, we get to ensure that you have the information that is necessary for you as an organization to know how to effectively engage with us in terms of what's the environment that is before us, what are the things that are influencing the department. And then obviously, that also lets you know where opportunities for partnerships exist for you and your respective networks, local chapters, as well as opportunities for the department to engage in. Anna Acton was going to be here. Sarah had invited her to come and do a presentation to include some of the independent living community. I will touch base on that later in the agenda. She unfortunately was ill this morning and not able to come down to be here, but we'll still provide that. So one of the things that I want to highlight here at the outset is what are the influencers that are not only affecting the environment that we're doing business today, but affecting the consumers that we're serving today and really having a major impact on our programs and services. And I'll start by saying that when you hear these influencers, it's very generational. If you're 20, you're going to hear and feel this in a different way than if you're 40 or 60 or 80, right? But nonetheless, depending on where you're sitting and depending on what generation you're in, these will have major implications, not just today, but in years to come, decades to come into the future. So let's start with the acceleration and the exposure that was brought on by COVID-19. It accelerated many things that are taking place. It exposed a lot of gaps in our society, in our programs and services. We have an environment today where person-centered, whole person approach is being embraced by systems that we never contemplated before. And I'll touch base on some of those later on. We have a reform of how government does business today and certainly into the future. When you think about the digital approach to delivering programs and services at a minimum, when you think about how we're leveraging remote work these days, we have large systems integration in ways we never thought of before. So for those of you that have been tracking the CalAIM reform and the supports that it now provides to individuals to stay living in the community, and we have an urgency to adapt, to modify, to modernize yesterday's business models to meet the environment that we're in, and the environment is going to rapidly continue to change in the coming 3, 5, 7+ years. One of the things that I have been reading almost nonstop about for the last few months is ChatGPT and the implications that it'll have on our workforce, the implications that it has on services, the implications it has on tomorrow's workforce. And so as Laura and Peter talk to you about some of the work that they're doing, that is a big variable, and it is moving very quickly in terms of what the jobs of tomorrow are going to look like. We have a shift in the economic base. Think about what is happening to the inner cities, the retail, how we're doing business these days, transportation systems, because people are so remote, and the impact that that is having on individuals, and the impact that it's going to have on the systems continuing to be viable. So let me talk a little bit about the federal, about the state level, high departmental level. Then I'll hand it off to Sue to talk about specialized services, and I'll come back and talk about independent living. So at the federal level, the RSA, the Rehabilitation Services Administration Commissioner, Dante Allen, an individual here from California with the ABLE Act Board, an individual with a disability, was nominated by President Biden, but he had to be renominated in this current calendar year because he was not appointed during the last year. Now, we know that the president has renominated him. What we don't know is the timing of his appointment to that position. He has to go through the Senate process. So stay tuned to that. Right now, civil servants at RSA are providing the leadership there. This spring, we have the meetings of the National Council of Agencies for the Blind and the Council of State Administrators for Vocational Rehabilitation in D.C. They're going to be focusing on three primary areas: program performance in terms of the number of people that are going to work and staying at work, program's fiscal performance, because many, many, many millions of dollars are going unused by the VR programs across the country, and then how each is using data to inform the work that they're doing, to inform the services that they are providing. On the state level, obviously, we all know that the governor published his budget back in January, and we now know that there's a forecast of $29.5 billion, that's with a B as in Bob, dollars of shortage in revenue, and a projected budget gap of $22.5 billion. So to address that, the governor has leveraged a number of things, such as extending timelines, deferring expenditures, and sweeping up expenditures that may not have been used, right? And some limited borrowing. One of the things that was not done to address the budget shortfall is use of the rainy day funds. Now, you might ask, well, why would that be the case if they're there? It's in anticipation that we do end up in a recession, and that recession is extensive, which will then require the use of those rainy day funds. At the same time, it's important to keep in mind that the agencies, our Health and Human Services agency's budget has increased over 42% over the last 4 years, 42% increase over the past 4 years, right? a couple of things that I'll call out in the current budget specific to the agency level. One is that our health care services department is seeking a waiver to provide temporary housing to individuals with significant mental illness. And they're also looking to provide the counties at the county level with the ability to provide temporary housing for individuals with significant behavioral health as they are going through treatment. Now, that is not a silver bullet for everybody. But think about this for a minute, folks. For the first time, we're beginning to view housing through the lens of healthcare, right? And yes, we may want it to go further, and yes, there's more conversations to come, but for the first time, we're beginning to view social services and things like housing as a benefit, as an element of healthcare. Agency continues to work through all of its budget levers to disrupt the disparities that exist and those that were exposed by COVID-19. We continue to implement many of the initiatives that were funded in the last 4 years, and we continue to look to expand the workforce systems in the healthcare arena. And under the state operations, a couple of things for you to be tracking. One is that we continue to advance the use of telework, remote work, and we continue the process of facility reduction. All that means is we also continue to look at how do we reduce the travel costs associated with that. At the Government Ops Agency, Operations Agency, they've established the Office of Data Innovation. And that is an office that is working directly with departments and programs to modernize how they deliver the services in today's environment with the influencers that I mentioned. Now, all of this means that the legislative process on the budget is underway. A number of hearings have been held, will continue to be held. And it also means that until the legislative process concludes sometime in May, June, we won't know what the final budget looks like. I want to also call out the fact that the governor signed into place AB 1195 this past fall. And the bill affirms the responsibility of state government to serve as a model employer. It affirms the requirement of agencies to develop an affirmative action plan to improve the employment of individuals with disabilities. And it clarifies and makes explicit that departments can use what is called a LEAP-only list, which means they can target individuals with disabilities to hire into their workforce. We also have an executive order that was signed this past fall by the governor. I encourage you to have a careful read of that executive order. It is very impactful, has a wide range of initiatives. I'm not going to touch base on all those, but I will highlight a couple of those. One is that whenever a department submits a request for budget action, that we have to include as part of that submission how we have addressed the inequities in the respective program and how have we engaged the respective communities to inform the actions that are being taken. Strategic plans need to be developed and will be published by each department on that front. And that is going to include language access for all the different populations. It also creates a commission to address racial inequities that exist within California. And one of the membership of that commission is the individuals with expertise in disability rights. So it's important to recognize how we keep increasingly ensuring that individuals with disabilities are at the table on these very important policy conversations that are taking place. All right. So let me shift to the departmental level. So for the 23-24 budget, this is the budget that is proposed. It would start in July 1. Good news is we, at this point, have no proposed reductions to our budget. We have about a $500 million budget, about a 1,900 positions. About 2,000 people are getting checks from the department as part of payroll every year. We did request the authority for the grant the transitions sheltered workshops into competitive integrated employment, community living fund, TBI expansion, and integrating employment into recovery continues to be topics of interest that the legislature has when it comes to our department. So we are also in the process of phasing out the subminimum wage sheltered workshops here in California, right? But keep something in mind when we talk about the sunsetting of the subminimum wage. It has been going on for decades. It's not an effort that started today, right? And the services that the Department of Rehabilitation provides is very focused on competitive integrated employment, not sheltered workshops settings. So we had what is known as the CIE blueprint, the competitive integrated blueprint. That was an administrative action that really led to, I believe, in the passage of SB 639. We have through the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, the Career Counseling Information and Referral, also a tool used for that transition, and a representation of how even at the congressional level, at the federal level, the shift away from sub-minimum wage. So the phase-out plan was developed during this last year. The Council on Developmental Disabilities has submitted that to the legislature. And again, what I will say here is that the Department of Rehabilitation and Department of Developmental Services commitment to this phase-out is longstanding. So supporting this transition is something we very much believed in, right? The other thing that I would lift up here is that there are about 4,100 individuals who are currently in a setting that pays them less than a federal minimum wage, right? And so we are going to continue to work over these coming couple of years to transition those folks into competitive and integrated employment. We are also celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Department of Rehabilitation. And so Kim Rutledge, our alleged deputy, is going to be leading that effort. And Sue will talk more about this. It also happens to be the 20th anniversary of Specialized Services Division. So the other thing I want to lift up here is that as part of the equity work that I mentioned earlier, we are working with a specific population, which is how do we increase the number of individuals with behavioral health disabilities that leave with a job, and how do we ensure that they leave with a job that is on parity? So what I mean by that is that our Black and brown communities lag behind in earnings when it comes to employment. And so universally, we're going to increase the number of people with behavioral health that go to work, and we're going to increase the earnings that everybody with behavioral health that goes to work has, and we're going to intentionally target our Black and brown communities so that they are on par with our Caucasian communities. Consumer payment card. If you have not heard, it offers consumers now a very easy, readily to use payment card. So if, for example, I needed a pair of pants for an interview, I now have the ability to walk into any store that sells those pants, pick out the ones that are suitable and that fit me, put the card on the counter, pay for them. And for those of you that have ever had to go through that, trust me, that is a huge improvement over what was taking place. It offers the ability to get books and supplies in a much more real time. And we've been working on this for decades. And it wasn't until recently that our administrative deputy changed all of our thinking from we needed to build a system to we simply buy a service. And that small shift, but rather impactful shift in thinking, has brought us to this point. We are one of the first in the country to provide a consumer of the Department of Rehabilitation with the ability to make these kinds of purchases just about in real time. And this also means for individuals that have hidden disabilities, they don't have to go to a store and disclose who they are and that they're part of the Department of Rehabilitation and why they have this authorization. They literally can just put the card on the table, pay for it, and be done. So let me skip down here to a couple of key position updates. So our chief information officer, Jake Johnson, himself an individual who was blind, was appointed into that position in December. We now have new managers within the information technology division. We have a vacant contracts chief and a vacant human resources chief that we are in the process of filling. Why do I say that to you? If anybody has the qualifications and the interest in working in those arenas, please submit your name, submit your applications. We look forward to hiring people with disabilities, but we can only do that when they are qualified for the positions and when they apply for the positions. Okay, I'm going to take a deep breath. I'm going to hand this off to Sue Palebath, our Deputy Director for Specialized Services. Sue?
Thank you. Thank you, Joe. Woo-hoo, thank you. All right, I get to do the fun stuff over here and talk about all the latest and greatest that's happening with specialized services. And of course, the biggest celebration this year is the anniversary of SB 105. Okay, SB 105, yay. Specialized services exist because of SB 105 and a lot to celebrate this year, right? So in my division, we have five sections, and one of those, of course, is deaf and hard of hearing services. And in celebration of SB 105, they'll be getting together, all of us, to celebrate that. And it's planning to be in Anaheim in the fall, and they're going to also do their SB 105 annual training. OIB, Older Individuals Who Are Blind Grant, We are going to announce the notice of intent to award next week. Don't know any of the results, of course, but so excited that we can continue providing those services to older individuals who are blind. And I'm one of those folks, just in case you don't know that. One of our biggest changes in specialized services is the redesigning of the training program for the business enterprise program. As Joe was mentioning, you know, everything's changed about the workplace, about employment, about what work looks like. All of that has changed, and it's kind of come through COVID. So those vendors who managed to survive the COVID shutdown, I mean, kudos to those folks. And if any of you are here, congratulations, because what a challenge it's been for all of you. And so what it's also done for us is we've taken a good hard look at how we train our future vendors, because it's changed. Doing it the way we used to do it and getting people ready for that workforce and that world of work and providing food service, that's over. And so everyone, our team and the vendors currently and those future vendors, need to learn how to come up and get prepared for that experience in order to be successful. Excuse me. So we've hired a new training officer. His name is Mark Leva. And currently we're working on completely revamping and redesigning the curriculum for the training program and hoping to vet our future vendors, our consumers from VFS here, who might want to be independent business owners and yet arm them with the skills and abilities they need to be successful. And that includes a lot of assessment, skills training, work experience, right? All of our vendors have agreed to become employers for potential consumers who want to be vendors as a work experience opportunity. So we see that as a big thing for them. All right. Orientation Center for the Blind. It's ironic. I usually want to forget that place. That's where I came from, but it's kind of weird. OCB continues to serve the same number of consumers annually, but through the smaller group cohort system. OCB also offers a two-week mobility boot camp, which is 80 hours of mobility all in 2 weeks for students that the Blind Field Service Counselors send up for that training. OCB is also a work experience site for all consumers with the department, not just those folks who are blind or visually impaired. And those work experiences are in groundskeeping, food service, custodial work, and also some office assistant work to hopefully get some people that experience they need to see what they might want to do and how they handle the pressure behind going to work. As a matter of fact, that's been one of the biggest topics in the last couple of years is about work experience is a priority for our department to get our folks to put them to the test, I guess it would be, and get them the experience so that they understand what work looks like and that the counselors can work more closely with those folks to get them the skills and good work habits necessary to go to work. By the way, Joe and I are going to take questions once Joe's finished speaking about independent living. So if you have questions, start saving them up because I do better with Q&A as well. Now, Blind Field Services. Sorry, I got too close again. Jeez. I'm going to let the experts of Blind Field Services do their thing later. That's Peter Dawson and Laura Rasmussen. And I think the greatest regional business specialist who's on the call, Nancy Ibarra. They're going to do their thing and share all the successes and what they've got going on at BFS. So instead, I'm going to kind of shift gears here and say that between Peter Dawson and Laura Rasmussen, they bring more than 55 years of experience in DOR, and they have managed to evolve and change and embrace the innovations of the department and all the up and coming initiatives and all the differences and changes that keep coming up. We know that the workforce is fluid. It's not solidified, and that we need leaders like them. Also, I couldn't do my job without them. Oh my goodness. And then one final note about that, for those of you who don't know, in 2006, I went to the Department of Rehab for Services, and my first counselor was Laura Rasmussen here. And so I'd like to give her credit because, honestly, I'm here today because of how she got me on the road to success. But I also am so grateful that I get to work alongside of Peter and Laura. So thank you, guys. I keep getting too close. Sorry about that. All right. And now I'm going to send it back to Joe, and I hope you have questions for us in a few minutes.
Community,
2480?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. There, I did it again. Yeah. Baby. Of course not.
Sarah won't be asking.
Fine, Jenna.
Well,
I'm the agenda, sorry.
Yeah. Okay. AB 2480. We had, I think, was a very, very fruitful community forum where we had so many of you and many of our community partners and our consumers all joined in a call. And I think what we were able to, right now we're working on solidifying how we're going to deliver the services to those folks who are 18 to 55 who need independent living services. We haven't solidified how we're going to deliver the services yet, but we have a pretty good idea. I think the consensus, and I think Sarah would agree, was very clear on what we'd like to see happen, and as well as how all of you would like to see us handle that. Do you have a comment about that, Joe?
No, we could take any questions.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Okay, then. All right. I'm going to throw it back to Joe.
All right. Okay. Is that okay? Good. Sound okay there? All right, so let me jump into to the independent living. And I mentioned at the outset, what are some of the influences that are taking place? And we talked a lot about systems integration. I'll talk a little bit more about that, because I think it's really not only where we are, but where we see society going. And so Sarah, as she mentioned, has been very active, both with the Blind Advisory Committee, 2480, and of course, a number of other things. And so thank you, Sarah, for asking us to include that in our conversation here today. And certainly I'll speak to this. And then As Sue said, I'd love to get into any questions that folks have. So let me, first of all, just talk more broadly about independent living, because when we talk about independent living, it's really on a number of different fronts. It's independent living centers, it's older individuals who wear blind program, it's traumatic brain injury, and a number of other programs on top of that. And essentially, they advance the Olmsted decision, which means that individuals with disabilities receive services in the least restrictive, most integrated setting that is possible. And it means that it supports individuals from being diverted from going into institutions and then facilitate the transition out of institutions for those individuals that have become institution. Ooh, I guess we're awake now. Okay. So, there are 28 independent living centers with some 60 locations in California, serving just under 27,000 individuals annually, right? And this past year, they served 1,600 individuals who were blind or visually impaired. 417 individuals were transitioned out of institutions, and 600, almost 700, are under the age of 14 that are receiving services. 13,000 are over the age of 60, right? So this is a system that is serving the full spectrum of ages of individuals with disabilities. So the independent living community, independent living centers, received funding on a number of different fronts from the American Recovery Rescue Act funding. One is to expand public health support services within the traumatic brain injury program, to expand public health workforce through the independent living centers, and to expand the public health workforce through the Assistive Technology Act programs, right? And then independent living centers also received a range of direct funding from the federal government to address the needs and unmet needs of individuals, particularly through the COVID era that we're in. And for those of you that may be tracking, VR was not the recipient of any of the American Recovery Act funding that took place. Let me talk briefly about the Aging Disability Resource Connection. And if I'm remembering correctly, we're going to have Susan here later to talk about the Master Plan on Aging. So this will be a little bit of a forerunner. And I think when you hear about the Master Plan on Aging, you'll see how a lot of this stuff so very much links together. So the what we call ADRCs began as a state and federal partnership to establish no wrong door into getting services that are necessary. Here in California, the ADRCs are led through a partnership between a AAA Area Agency on Aging and the Independent Living Center, and includes a wide range of partner organizations. So when you think of the no wrong door concept, it's essentially think about, I come in for a service, I need a service that is in another system, and I'm being connected to that system to get those services. In California, we have 17 ADRCs that have been established, and we have 8 that are emerging. We have 26 of the 28 independent living centers that are in the ADRC connection partnerships. So we have also the traumatic brain injury program, and there are about 12 providers with some HCBS funding that we received that are serving 35 counties across the country, right? And the services there are also at diverting individuals from institutions, as well as getting individuals or institutions out of those institutions. And all of this is an element of the long-term support services program. I'm sure Susan will talk more about that today. But let me talk specifically about the community living program, right? The community living funded. Okay, so what is it? The community living fund was $10 million that was allocated to really focus on a couple of different things, diversion from institution, transition out of institution. But in addition to it being part of the long-term services support of the Master Plan on Aging, it really is aimed at being a bridge to help individuals transition or get out of institutions where the other systems, the other programs may not meet that entire need, right? So what might that look like? Well, think about somebody who's on Medi-Cal but needs a service that Medi-Cal may not cover, right? Or think about somebody who is just outside of the range of being eligible for Medi-Cal, but is also at risk of being institutionalized. So all of this funding is aimed at focusing on that population, and it is aimed at developing the capacity of many systems. This is not just independent living centers. This is independent living centers. It's the area agencies on aging. It's TBI centers. It's OIB centers. So this is funding that's available to anybody who is working with that population to get them out of those types of settings. So I talked about this. Let me skip down here. Okay. Let me talk a little bit about integration, inclusion, and then we can open this up for questions, right? Because if you heard me mention this in several different ways, this community living fund, I think, is another example of this, because it's a fund that you have to be working with so many other systems in terms of meeting the whole needs of that individual. So we know that true systems integration is really being approached in ways that we just have never seen before, right? And it's really becoming more and more prevalent, both in policy as well as in allocation of fundings. That to be eligible for the funding, you have to be engaging and coordinating with services across systems, right? And frankly, it's just, if you think about the basic concept of person-centered and whole person approach, there's not one single system that can ever meet the whole needs of any one individual. And I don't care how we restructure these systems, it'll never happen, right? So the question becomes, how do we start looking at this more holistically from that person-centered lens and approach that? And we certainly know that we, as individuals who are blind and visually impaired, have long advocated for every system to better meet the needs, our needs, and certainly the needs of other populations. And so today, these systems are embracing this in ways like never before. Earlier, I mentioned CalAIM. There are some 13 services that were previously deemed to be social services and thus not eligible to be covered under healthcare. Well, under the CalAIM reform, those services are now seen as part of healthcare. Those are services that recognize that the health of an individual living in their community can be greatly advanced when they receive those services. Now, that can look like overnight success here, but there's no overnight success here. This is decades and decades in the making. But what it means is that these systems need the expertise, for example, of knowing how to serve somebody who is blind and visually impaired. That expertise has to be brought to this system, such as managed care, right? So that they can lean on our expertise in delivering those supports to that population, right? And one of the things that I think is important for us to recognize is that this is not a carve-out for individuals. It's a carve-in of ensuring that the expertise, that the population is truly being served. Now, we're seeing this in workforce. We're seeing this in education. We're seeing this virtually in every system, right? And when you think about this, at the end of the day, when you talk about true integration, inclusion, what are you talking about? You're talking about systems that have a universal design so that they are usable and can benefit everyone, regardless of how they come to that system for services. So I'm going to stop talking there. Sarah, I don't know if you guys want to offer some time for questions, but we're certainly glad to take some if desired.
I do have an announcement. I forgot to say something, which is totally typical. I did it again. What is the deal here with me? SB 105 is going to be celebrated at the Orientation Center for the Blind. And that's on July 14th, an all-day open house. Everyone's invited. We're going to put on our best show we can and have a more sort of an experiential opportunity for folks, especially those folks who don't know how we who are blind do what we do. But it's also just a beautiful campus, an opportunity to get together and celebrate that great day. Do we have questions?
Yes. All right. So if there are any questions, raise your hand and somebody is going to either run to you with a mic, or if no mic, you can say your question and I will repeat it for the benefit of everybody in the room and those that are online. Okay, we'll start with Zoom. People in Zoom land, any questions you'd like to ask?
And now we have a raised hand. Just a moment. Will?
Okay. Any questions?
Looks like they lowered it.
You want to either raise your hand and we'll get a mic, or we'll call it out and I'll repeat it.
This is Sharon Jovanaz, but all of us could be better quiet.
Hello.
Starting a thousand more ways to be here. It's such a good time.
So for those of you who didn't hear, Sharon from the Lighthouse is asking how I see the CalAIM services wrap around with services such as OIB might be providing, right? So really good question, Sharon, and I hope I got that close enough. Really good question. So here's the way I look at this, right? First of all, I've never met an OIB director who said they had enough money, right? And I'm not being flip about that. I mean, that's just the reality. So then the question becomes, all right, if healthcare now provides for a range of services the individual needs, then the question becomes, how does Sharon, who is an OIB provider, look at that and say, all right, I got services 3, 5, and 7 that I can get for this individual through managed care. And so she's able to work with managed care, provide the services that that individual is eligible for, paid by managed care. And then maybe I need service number 8, which is not paid by managed care. So now, Sharon, it doesn't have the financial burden of providing all of those services out of OIB. She's only providing one of those out of OIB and the others out of the managed care, the healthcare system. But the beauty of that is that I, as a person who's getting those services, you know, to the extent that Sharon has partnered with managed care, I'm getting those services still from somebody that has that expertise in serving people who are blind and visually impaired. But here's the key to this, right? One, until managed care partners up, or Sharon, I'm sorry, Sharon, I'm just using you as an example. Mm-hmm. So until Sharon partners up to, with managed care, they're not going to know who Sharon is. And here's the other thing. If Sharon doesn't develop that relationship with managed care, at some point, managed care is going to build out that expertise. And once they do, good luck cutting into that, right? So that's why I so encourage this. But here's the other reason that I think it's invaluable. One, I always say follow the money, right? Follow the money. I mean, folks, even if we add another $1 million to OIB, it's not even close to what might be necessary. However, the managed care system has many, many, many more millions that can be leveraged, right? So that's why, frankly, for me, I am very excited about the opportunity for other systems to fund, to provide the services that individuals who are blind and visually impaired have long needed to continue to live in their community. So thank you for that, Sharon. That's a really good question.
Okay. The person with telephone number ending in 879, you may unmute.
Allison, is there anybody on Zoom with their lights, their hands up?
We have someone in Zoom. Can
okay,
you hear
go
me?
Go ahead and ask your question as loud as you can.
All right. So Nellie's question, I'm going to paraphrase Nellie's question. Nellie's question is, now that there's this funding available for these services through managed care, how does an agency access those services and how bureaucratic will it be? Right. Okay. So first, let me talk about what these services, sort of where this money comes from, right? So remember that when you talk about managed care, you're talking about CalAIM reform. What you're talking about is Medi-Cal. And Medi-Cal is through the Center for Medical of CMS at the federal level. So there is a litany of requirements in terms of using Medi-Cal dollars and the associated billing. So that's not all in California. I know that our colleagues at Healthcare Services are very focused in helping community-based organizations to be able to lean into how to deal with that navigation, how to do that. And it's interesting. I was having a conversation with a provider in the community not too long ago who was really thinking outside of the box and said, I'm good at delivering services. All that billing stuff gives me a headache. I'm going to use a third party to do that billing for me.
Hello.
And I thought, whoo, now that's strategy at play. But the way that is accessed, going back to using Sharon as an example, is because Sharon establishes that partnership with managed care. Managed care sees Sharon as a partner in delivering those services, and then they develop that inner working about how will referrals be made, et cetera, et cetera. So it will require, it's not going to be through the Department of Rehabilitation or healthcare services. It's not going to be through any of that. It's going to be between the local community-based organization and the managed care plan in terms of establishing the partnership to then be able to leverage it in delivering the services.
All right, Julie.
So I'm just a little confused. So how are we going to figure out, like, if let's say we establish this care with CalAIM, how am I going to figure out when I'm going to be billing DOR or when I'm billing CalAIM?
Well, that'll be easy, okay? That'll be the easy part about who do you bill, right? If you're billing, if you were providing a service that you want funded by managed care, then you're billing the managed care plan. And by the way, you're not going to be billing CalAIM. CalAIM is the sort of the terminology, but I get your point. You're going to be billing managed care, right?
Can you give me examples on the services that we would be billing for the managed care?
Can I? Yeah, go ahead.
I had one more question about HCBA.
So when it comes to CalAIM, so CalAIM is different across the state. It goes through the managed care plan. So it could be HealthNet, it could be Anthem Blue Cross. I have to say that I'm really proud to say that Valley Center for the Blind is the first blindness agency that I know of that has applied and got CalAIM funding.
We also look at the whole person. This keeps getting louder. I'm so sorry, guys. And what happens is you have a person who gets Medi-Cal. So that person gets Medi-Cal, and so you look at if they need any transition or diversion services. So when we think of somebody who's blind, maybe that transition or diversion services, they need some AT training, or maybe possibly, and I'm not sure how this looks, you know, maybe they need to go to Hatlin or OCB or whatever it may be. So you put together a care plan that is very specific to that person and their needs, and then you submit it to the managed care system, and they either accept or reject it. And that's how that one works. Does that help, Julie? Okay, awesome. What's your other HCBS question?
Before you go to that, let me add a couple of things here. I think at the heart of these questions, something that is really important for us to just think about and come to grips with. At the outset, I said that one of the influencers that is very much at play is how so many systems are having to change their business models. And so I think that at the heart of these questions about particularly when you're looking at leverage managed care is you can't think about that you're going to be doing the things that you've been doing in the same way in a different system, right? Community-based organizations, for-profits, everybody is having to rethink what's the business model that works in the environment that we're in today with the influencers that are at play, right? And so that's an important distinction to be made, because the idea that we are going to go to managed care and say, well, this is the way I deliver services and OID, so that's the way I want to do it, not going to happen. And again, as part, as I mentioned before, it's not because just managed care is being a stick in the mud. That's not that. It's there are requirements that flow from the federal government on how that money can be used and how the invoicing and all of that must take place, right? So rule number one for me, and trust me, Sue and the rest of the team here will tell you, we have been deep in this. How do we rethink our business models? How do we rethink the way that we approach delivering and getting services paid for in today's environment?
Okay. So, Joe, I think there's a gap that needs to be recognized here, though.
Yeah, they can.
In all the what you have just laid out. There are a few OIB programs like the Lighthouse and Dell McIntosh, a couple of others, that are similar, and in Dale McIntosh's case it is, but there are a few OIB agencies that are similar to ILs and ADRCs in the sense that they have a lot of resources. But there are many, many OIB agencies that don't. And I think, I know there's a way to get some assistance through DHCS in learning about this process, but these agencies are going to have a really tough time without some assistance by somebody, and I don't know who it should be, whether it, you know, it needs to be a council to sort of help the way through. But if we're really serious about system integration, and Joe, you've been preaching this for a long time and not doing too much about OIB itself, but preaching system integration, if you're really serious about it, we need to help these agencies figure out how they can actually access those CalAIM dollars.
Jeff, I couldn't agree with you more, Jeff. And you are correct that there is a Department of Healthcare Services that is the state's Medicaid, Medi-Cal directors, right? They're the ones that everybody works through, have done a number of things. One, they've been holding many, many forums to make people more aware with a lot more detail than I'm offering you here. Two, they are providing funding to help their local, the community-based organizations to develop these transitions and to figure out how they can better partner with the managed care systems. So a lot of this is out there. I know that Sue and the team have continued to share out when those forums are taking place. so that people can take advantage of that, right? So, and I'm sure more will come because it's not just, Jeff, to your point, it's not just OIB, but clearly OIB applies here. There's many other organizations that are also in the same boat, but like, how do we do this? How do we integrate into that?
Do we have any hands up on Zoom for questions?
I believe this is Linda.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. First of all, I want to say hello to Joe and Peter and Laura. I'm Linda Samolsky. And I'm not sure if this question is appropriate at this time, but I do want to get it in. It's kind of twofold. One is, what is the criteria for serving people who are students who are dreamers? And my second question is, we know that adult education for ESL learners has been very inaccessible in the past. And that is a path to employment services. So what is being done, or how can we help make adult education more accessible for ESL learners who are blind and vision impaired? Thank you.
Right. Well, thank you for your question. I'm going to look to Laura and Peter to include that when they do their presentation. They're going to get deep into the services that Blindfield Services provide. So I'll when you guys do that, you'll, I'm sure, address those questions. Okay.
Any other hands up in the Zoom, please?
Not at the moment.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's my HCBS question. So for HCBS funding, do they have to have a dual diagnosis? Do they have to be part of regional center also to get that funding?
I'm not sure what HCBS funding you're referring to. So earlier when I talked about the HCBS funding, I'm talking about traumatic brain injury. And so the traumatic brain injury program received $5 million of home and community-based services funding that came to California. And so that is specifically for individuals with traumatic brain injury. And they may, I don't think they're regional center consumers, because if they are, they would have access to all of the services through that system.
Okay.
Am I right about that?
That's what I agree.
I think Sue is saying yes. The community living fund?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes and no. The community living fund, that the eligibility for that is if you're a Medi-Cal recipient, it's a service you would need that Medi-Cal does not cover when it comes to transition or diversion. Okay. Or if you are, I think it's at 300% of the federal poverty level. So in other words, you may not be Medi-Cal eligible, but you're less than 300% of federal poverty level, so you'd be eligible for the Community Living Fund Transition Services.
On the gap.
Yeah. Okay.
Any more questions?
One more quick question. This is Eric Skivers. I just was wondering if you would repeat the location and date for the AB 105 20-year celebration, please.
Oh, SB 105?
Oh, SB 105.
It's okay.
Oh, mom is just like not digging that. Sorry.
SB 105 celebration at OCB will be on July 14th all day.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Sarah, I'm going to ask the Zoom room again, because I was getting text messages that they couldn't chime in. So I'm going to ask again, are there any hands up in the Zoom room?
There is one. Laureen, you may unmute.
Hello? Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, great. I had a question about self-employment, and I'm a person that's trained visually impaired, trying to do my own business, you know, tutoring online remotely, because I'm also a caregiver for my parent. I'm wondering if there's funding available for people who have business plans and have a model of what they want to do. You know, I've outlined, because I have education background and a teaching credential and, you know, a lot of skills, but now I have a unique situation where I need to work more remotely. Is there funds available for people that have their own business models?
So I'm going to, again, look to Laura and Peter to include that. They're going to get really deep into all matters, employment and Blindfield services. And I think they'll certainly touch on self-employment as part of that. I did want to make just one quick comment. We're in this world of hybrid. And as I mentioned, there's such a generational piece to this. But, you know, kudos to CCB to lean into this place and lean into this whole space of trying to bring us together, both in person. We obviously benefit from that, and remotely for those that can't be here. There's nothing easy about this, folks. But here's in my mind, here's how this plays out. Where we are today to compare to March of 2020, leaps and bounds. And it's my humble opinion that where we will be in 3 years or 5 or 7 years when it comes to this hybrid way of engaging will equally be leaps and bounds. So I just one kudos. This will all get better, folks. This will all get better as the systems evolve and our own practices about how to do this remotely evolve. This is the way of the future, in my opinion. So thank you.
It's about inclusion. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we're going to let Peter and Laura take over it.
All right. Thank you very much. And before we get going, if people want to stand up and take a quick stretch break so that you're like awake and regenerated to hear all about going to work, we'll give you just a couple minutes for that. My name is Laura Rasmussen, and I'm the District Administrator for Blindfield Services. With me today is Peter Dawson. He's the Regional Director. So the way this works is Peter is the one that leads BFS. I'm the one that makes sure it keeps going. So he kind of drives, and I make sure the car works, and then we have some other amazing staff along the way. So I'm going to give you some background. I just do feel like a little bit of history is good here, and then we'll hear from Nancy about how BFS Business Services work, then back to Peter to talk about the future and who knows what, because he's been known to go rogue on us. And so it's definitely worth waiting around to hear him speak. And then Jamie from Valley Center for the Blind is going to be talking about some great employment stuff that is going on there. So I've been in this position for 3.5 years, but, you know, because of COVID, really haven't had the opportunity to interact with a lot of you. So just to give you a little bit of background on myself, I actually grew up legally blind, grew up in all those systems that we have for blind kids, the Camp Bloomfield. I did all that kind of stuff. Went to college, got some visual correction that allowed me to function in the low vision range, in the high partial range. And then a few years ago, like 10 years ago now, was able to get some additional medical stuff that actually got me more vision. So you look at me, you think I see perfectly fine. That's still not the case, but definitely more than I was before. So anyway, my point is I might look like I can see fine, but I totally get where people are coming from. Like I've told people, I've been all over the vision scale. A visual, you know, the big E all the way down. Well, not to 2020, but, you know. Anyway, I want to give you a little bit of background about why I have this passion I have right now with DOR. I actually was a DOR client back in the early 80s. My mom took me to DOR because somebody told her they might be able to help with college. The gentleman that I talked to said, yeah, we're limited money right now. Here's a bank draft you can use every semester.
Sorry.
It's okay.
I don't know if we needed to pause or.
And you're back.
Okay.
We can hear you guys
back.
Now. This is Nancy Ibarra.
Okay.
Yes,
right,
we could hear
thank
now.
You.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
And I will be quite honest, in the early days of my work with DOR, there was assistive technology, but they could be quite stingy about it. So people didn't, and AAT was very poor. I mean, Peter reminded me that he used DeckTalk to go to law school, and I have no idea how he did that. I think I would have pulled all my hair out. But, you know, life, you know, we go forward, and my kind of mantra is now is we're not your parents' DOR. You know, when your parents went to DOR, maybe you, but it was all about just providing services, hoping for the best. Now we're planning for the best. And it's a kind of a two-way street, because Sue tells you how wonderful DOR services are, which is really makes me feel good. On the other hand, when she walked in the door, she was ready for more. She actually put in a lot of work to this as well. She said, I want to work. What do I need to do? We planned out a school program, all that kind of stuff. And by the way, Sue and I have had the discussion. We're okay with sharing about each other's experiences, but she put into this. So that's what I want people to understand is that, yes, DOR provides great services, good customer services, hopefully all the time, but it's also a matter of people being understanding when they come to DOR, it's about work, maybe not work tomorrow, but it's about work. We have had just a tremendous, change actually in the way that we provided services. If you are interested in DOR services, if what we say means something to you, this afternoon you may go out to the DOR table and somebody will help you to apply for services online. Or you go home, go to the DOR website and go onto our portal, apply for services. Very simple, write in your name, phone number, you know, where you live, and that you want to work with somebody who's experienced with working with vision loss. That will be sent to one of our team managers who will make sure that you are contacted as soon as possible. So that's a huge change. Remember the days when there was the application, it was mailed out, it had to be sent back, somebody had to help you sign it. It was ridiculous. So that is one way that we are improving our services. Now you can do your initial interview and meetings over the telephone or Zoom or Teams or in person. So we have many, many different ways to serve you. We have, our services are all designed to be directly, related to a vocational outcome. So again, we do the expanded vocational preparation services, including labor markets. So, we definitely need for individuals to see that we are working to get you a job at some point. We are not about, yeah, we do train you people. We do. But we are not going to train you to be an underwater basket weaver, because there's just no jobs for that. Okay. I mean, I know that sounds ridiculous, but that's why I do it, because there's some jobs that it's like, sounds ridiculous to some people, but that's the reality. And we want to make sure that there's some success, that you have that option, the opportunity for success, the best opportunity. We now have our business specialists working with consumers as you walk, you know, as soon as you walk through the door, almost, you know, within a few weeks, you can be talking to somebody about what the labor market is like in your area. Nancy's going to talk about that a little bit more down the road. We also offer work experience. Joe mentioned it. Work experience is, to me, it's not technical, but it's probably one of the best things to come along to DOR in forever. Work experience started out with the students. The student, because of WIOA, required that we spend additional time with students, time and money and energy. What work experience does is allows the individual to go to a work site, get work to on a job, get paid real money, minimum wage or better, on that job, and learn a skill. So that's what we do from the student end, is more about learning the skill. From the adult end, we have that same experience, but it's a little bit more about work, you know, understanding that when you go to work, it's going to be about, you know, public transportation, if that's what you need, and figuring out something about accommodations and figuring out what's right for you. There is hopefully an aspect of learning a skill, but it's just about getting some current work experience. It's real work that goes on a job application. And as you know, that's often the case with the blind that have not had any work experience. It's not uncommon for us to see a 30 and 40 year old who's never worked. And if you've never worked, you don't understand what the world of work is like. So we have these opportunities and we can make them almost anywhere. So again, I'll let Nancy talk about some of those placements that we've done. And Joe talked about the CPC card. That basically is, like I said, a credit card. My day, of course, I went to the bookstore with a bank draft. The person would say, I don't know what, sometimes they would just cash it as a check. But then they got to the point where, I don't know what this is. You got to go stand in this special line over there, which was embarrassing enough. But for me, I couldn't go to the bookstore with my friends and pick out the books that I want and walk through the door. And so not only could I not do that, I'd have to explain why I was going by myself to do it. With this new card, the individual goes to the bookstore, picks out their books, shows, gives them that credit, looks like a credit card, processed, end of story. No one even knows that it's DOR. I mean, it does say DOR in small letters on the card, but your friends aren't looking at that, right? So these are ways that we are elevating the experience so that people are gaining independence, because that is an independence thing now. And we actually focus on, for some of our younger students, that are our younger individuals that we serve, they've never had an experience with a credit card. They don't, you know, so that's part of our education as well, that financial literacy. And that's, we're developing that with some other programs right now that should, we should be able to stand that up any time now. So that's one of the, that's one of the nice, services that we're with. Assistive technology, we are able to do that earlier in the plan than we have ever since Peter took over. That's been a piece of cake. It's true. I mean, it's difficult. Don't get me wrong. It's not, it's a painful process for everybody. But again, back when I started, when computers became a big deal, I had leadership saying, well, they could go to the library. You know, they can go to the assistive technology center. That doesn't work. It doesn't work that you get an hour on the assistive technology at the lab. Now we get students and individuals that needed that assistive technology, you know, as soon as we can. And we can do it, you know, it depends on what it is. It's, again, it's still, we still unfortunately have state processes that we have to go through, but we are working on breaking some of those barriers as well. Somebody asked about self-employment. Self-employment is an option. Self-employment does involve a lot of work on your part, I will be quite honest, because we look at how successful the plan can be, but there is a lot of support for that. So that's something that I would encourage you to speak directly with a counselor about. You know, we need to show that, you know, there's a reasonable chance that it's going to be a success. And we do, unfortunately, have some limitations. We can't fund everything related to the business, but we are, we can be a good resource depending on what you want to do. But that is definitely something I would talk on an individual basis about. With your counselor. And again, we have a couple of counselors who are outside today at our booth who could, you know, maybe help you with some of the little bit more of the questions you might have. Let me see. I get the chance. This is my exciting part. I don't remember if Joe talked about this specifically, but we have a state internship program that's available to individuals that have developmental or cognitive disabilities. BFS is showing up to that table too. We have an individual right now who's doing a state internship. That internship is paid. When that internship is over, they will be eligible for a LEAP certification. So there is ways, these pathways into state jobs are becoming better and better and better. I mean, some of you might remember that a LEAP certificate back in the day was only good to be a janitor or a groundskeeper. That's not the case anymore. We've had many levels of LEAP certifications going through, and it's been a huge advantage to Blind Field Services and to consumers going to work, because they actually, some of them actually come work for us. We actually have a lot of interns right now that actually, it's really exciting. People are actually seeking out internships with Blind Field Services. So we're able to start training people as counselors before they even come to work for the department, which is really exciting. Back in my day, there was no interns. There was no graduate assistants. Some of our internships are paid. Some are not paid. That kind of depends on funding. But grad students need to do internships. So they are seeking us out. They do want to work with individuals who are blind, which is good. You know, people aren't afraid of us anymore. We have had some amazing successes in Blind Field Services. We lead the way when it comes to income. Across the rest of the state, our years go from July to July. So for the last fiscal year, our hourly wages were $27.39 across the state. That's, we closed 370 people successfully, and the average was $27. and 39 cents. The weekly average was $863.89. Again, our district Blindfield Services is higher than any other district in the state. That's consistently been the case. And we actually continue to do that because for the first 9 months of this year, our average wage is now up to $28.25. And our average hourly, our average weekly wage is up to $891.04. So we are doing extremely well in that point. We are also, like Sue said, we're standing up BEP again. And let's see, somebody had a question about ESL for a blind user, and I'm gonna have to get back to that one. But I would like to turn this over to Nancy Ibarra to talk about some of the ways that Blindfield Services helps how Blindfield Services helps identify vocational goals and some of the other programs that we've got going. And Nancy is the lead business specialist. So while she doesn't supervise the four other business services, she leads the way in providing the training, and she's had just amazing results. So go take it. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you guys. Can you guys hear me clearly?
Yes.
Great. Well, thank you. I'm so excited to be here today. This is something new and fun and amazing that we're able to Zoom in. And first of all, I want to start off with, my name is Nancy Ibarra. I am the Regional Business Specialist for Blindfield Services. I have black glasses, black long hair. My background has a San Francisco bridge. Hopefully I can go visit the bridge soon. I think it's so much fun just, you know, exploring the great parts of California. My pronouns are she and her, and excited to be here today. So let's start off with, what is a regional business specialist and what is it that I do? Well, first, I cover the entire state of California, and I work with our amazing 9 units in Blindfield Services. I am housed in the Norwalk office in LA County. Go Dodgers, LA County. So super excited to be here. And I work with a business specialist. We have 4. One great neat thing, well, I think there's a lot of neat things about being a business specialist or regional, is that we provide dual customer service. We work with consumers and businesses. We work with the businesses on the work side, any support that they need. But we work at the front end as well, like Laura and our team has shared, Sue and Joe and Peter will as well. We work with our consumers one-on-one. So I think it's really neat that the way we continue to lead is by providing dual customer service to our consumers and to our businesses. And along with our teams, we have that collaborative effort that we're able to work with all counselors, all service coordinators. So it's really neat to be able to have that partnership on a statewide. Our business specialists currently serve all 9 units. We have coverage. And one thing that our business specialists are able to do is provide that local level support. They're able to cover the areas that they're housed in. And I'm able to support all business specialists statewide, whether it's a windmills training, a disability etiquette, or they just need a case staff, a consumer who's interested in going into a field, and we're able to partner up and find some labor market that supports that plan that they're interested in working in. So our business specialists develop labor market plans to inform consumers and do our staff. When creating plans, we want to make sure that there's going to be a job for our consumers when they complete their training and education. As business specialists, we want to make sure that they're also getting great paying jobs. Like Laura just shared, the hourly wage is $27.39. I think that's so amazing because we're showing the value in the work that our staff is doing when we're seeking for employment and we're creating these plans. again, like Laura shared, this isn't your parents' DOR. This is a new way of working together and finding and seeking employment. A creative thing that DOR has done is partnered with Foundations for California Community Colleges through adult and student paid work experiences. We have both student work experiences and paid adult work experiences. When I first got hired with the department, I realized one of my struggles that I had with working with both was they had no work experience to put on their resumes. And we know the value and the importance of having work experience on your resume. We only had education and training on your resumes. And I think that as the department keeps continuing and moving forward and working in innovative ways by providing paid work experience, that's something that we're able to really work in ways of what best fits for our participants, whether they're students or adults, and our businesses as well. So if you hear me say FCCC, that's just a short way of saying Foundations for Community Colleges. So one thing I do want to share with you is that student work experience under FCCC rolled out about 3 years ago. And when it rolled out, it was very scary for a lot of students. And when I say scary, it's because a lot of our students were really scared to actually start working. FCC, which Foundations for California Community College, is the employer of record. And DOR partners with our consumers and finding work sites. And the consumer shares with either the business specialist or the service coordinator or the counselor of where they want to work. We want to make sure that they're able to gain valuable work experience at a work site that they will enjoy working and also getting paid for it. DOR plays a huge role in being a timekeeping supervisor. What the timekeeping supervisor does, it approves timesheets, approves I-9s in a system called Workday. And we also follow up with businesses to ensure that we're supporting businesses and all needs as well. Currently, we have 2 timekeeping supervisors for student work experience, 2 timekeeping supervisors for adult work experience. And the neat part about my role is that I'm able to take part in both. I am the only one in the state that has access and that is really hands-on with adult work experience and student work experiences. Usually there's different timekeepers for each district. So why do I share that with you? I share that with you because about 3 years ago, like I shared, when student work experiences rolled out and the fear was there for our students, our students were really fearful because they thought they were going to lose their benefits, the fear of getting out there and working. Well, one great neat thing that we were able to do is refer them to a work incentive planners who have those conversations with them that they're able to provide and share that great feedback that they can do the work experiences and they will not lose their benefits. So it gives them more of a comfort and understanding of what they're getting into. And BFS has really led the way. We have done 12,300 hours under student work experience. And the valuable work experiences that our students have worked in is in customer service, food service, retail, libraries, dispatch, office assistant, teacher assistants, and also too, BFS has the highest in the state work experiences. So it's really neat because it's something that I really do value so much. And students that are the ages of 16 to 21 are considered our student work experiences. And now that we have adult work experiences, when they turn 22 years old, we can roll them over to an adult work experience. Adult work experience through FCC rolled out in October of last year. And as today is April 1st, we have worked 1,500 hours. And I think it's so amazing to see that we had interest in some of our students who aged out and continuing to want to work. and the interest that is there for adults who have never worked. And we're talking about adults who are interested in working in the healthcare area, food service, retail, education, customer service. And we even had someone working in a radio station, which was so neat. It was so exciting. So it's so nice to see the value that the department has vested and partnered up with our consumers in providing that quality work experience. Feedback that I've received from students and adults about this work experience, I'm really hands-on. I love to talk to our consumers. You know, they normally still send me emails or a phone call, and I love to hear from them because I love to have feedback and share that with our teams. Is that the physical activity that it involves in waking up every day, getting ready, going to work, the social connections that they had, the daily structures that it gave them, and the fun extra money made a huge difference to every consumer. And that's why every year I'm always reaching out to our to Peter, Laura, and to our executive team for more hours for student work experience, because our students are always coming back and wanting to work more and do more. So it's really nice to see that our new generation moving forward is interested in working, and that we're setting the tone, and that our adults who have never worked now want to continue to work because they appreciate the social connections and the structure that they weren't part of before. Because that's what a work site and a job does bring to everybody's everyday lives. But do you want to know who else I've broken barriers with, which is so interesting because I'm a mother of two. I have a 15-year-old daughter and a 12-year-old son, is parents. Yes, parents. I had a conversation with a mother when I first rolled out the first student work experience. And this mom was so angry with me because she was sitting in my office and I asked her son, "Where do you want to work?" And she said, "Are you serious? My son can't work. He's blind." And I thought to myself and I said, okay, so I have to break barriers with consumers. I have to break barriers with businesses. And I also got to partner up with parents and break these barriers because they don't want their children to work. And I took that very personal because I wanted to make sure that everybody had a different lens, a different view, a different scope of what we can all do together. And this is so important for the student and for his mom and for myself to be having that conversation and seeing how important and how valuable work really is. And that just because you do something differently doesn't mean you can't do it. We all do things differently. And I think sometimes parents need that reminder as well. And I wanted to go into a success story because I know that I shared about breaking barriers with parents as well. And it's kind of like that food for thought that is left and friendly reminders of when consumers come to our to a DOR office, we look at them as a whole. We are there as a we. We're not there as a they. It's really something that we want every consumer to bring back, that when they're interested in applying for services or when they refer an uncle, a mom, a dad, a cousin, a friend, a neighbor, a brother or sister, that we're seeing it as a we, as an opportunity for all of us to continue to grow and give back. It's really important that we see it from that specific lens. So with that, the successful story that I love to share with you started off with Miss N, is a first generation daughter of parents who immigrated from the Middle East to California. Soon after she was born, it was determined by the medical staff that she was legally blind due to a congenital eye condition. Her parents did not accept this and constantly told her that she needed to pretend that she could see. So she and her mother suffered from long-term domestic violence, verbal abuse by her father. Her father told her that she was damaged and nothing more than a mistake. This led to a lot of emotion and trauma, mental health issues for which she would need treatment. Her mother explained the pain was part of life. When her father began to arrange a marriage when she was 16, he told her not to let her other know that she was blind because she was a broken child and she was disgraceful. He told her that it was his duty to make sure she marries and makes a happy husband, raise children, and stay home. She did not agree. So she decided on her own when she was in high school to connect with Blindfield Services, the Department of Rehabilitation, when she was 17. As a high school graduate, she came closer to domestic violence, and she became fearing of her life. She started planning a way out of this home situation. The day she turned 18, she ran away to a shelter for battered women and never looked back. Her parents disowned her and did not have it in her to connect with her. So she instead relied on herself and adopting others into her life, including long-term relationships with BFS and DOR. BFS has a sister through college and a master's degree in social work, with Bucks and Supply independent living skills training, devices, assistive technology training, the use of a computer, and reading print material, orientation and mobility with a white cane, and then Keem, a service dog, interview clothing, counseling, guidance, job placement services. She obtained a job as a case manager for veteran services in Los Angeles, where now she assists homeless veterans. She rises early at 3 a.m. to make it work on time, and her shift is from 7 a.m. to 3:30. She works full-time and earns $56,000 a year with benefits. She's extremely satisfied with her job and the services from Blindfield Services, and she can now continue to move forward and have her own family. This really touched me because, like I shared, I am a mother. But I'm also a daughter. I'm also a friend. I'm also a neighbor. So once again, when our consumers come to DOR, we want to make sure that they feel like they can have that conversation and that we really want to make sure that we ensure and provide them with the labor market for those job opportunities that are out there. Once a case is closed, when they're successfully closed, that doesn't mean they're closed and they're done. It's literally the beginning to a new journey. It's a beginning to a journey where they're going to continue to have more relationships with their coworkers and with life and become a taxpayer and continue to move on. So with that being said, I will pass it on back to my regional director, Peter Dawson. And it really has been such an amazing pleasure being here with you today. And thank you so much.
Good morning, everybody. I know we've been sitting a long time, and I want to save time for Jamie, who's next to me, who will tell you about some specific people that she's placed and what's important in terms of what they need to do in order to get placed and get a great job. So I'm going to keep my comments relatively short, and so we can get to Jamie and open it up for questions and answers before we break for the lunch. So thank you, Nancy, for sharing that story. I remember that story, and it moved me as well. And I was so happy that the people she got connected with in BFS were able to get her out of that mess she was in and to lead her own life, which certainly wasn't the one her parents wanted for her, but that's the way it goes. Sorry, parents. And I you know, when Sarah Harris asked me to come to this, I appreciated it, even though I realized later that I was going to be on a plane this afternoon right during my Aztecs Final Four playoff game. So that shows my devotion to you all. I just want you to know that. And yeah. So you know, I was thinking what to say. I changed my notes based on everything Joe and Sue and Laura already said, because I like I said, want other people to tell you some other things that I think are important. But I will say this, you know, what are we here for? And like Laura said, my job in the last 3.5 years, the regional director is a relatively new position. It's been hard for a lot of us regional directors in the 14 different districts, BFS being one of those, to kind of let go of our old job as the district administrators and let people like Laura do all those hearings and personnel issues and problems. That it's hard for me to let go of that, believe it or not. I thought I would just love to get rid of it, but it's really hard to let go of those old things that you're used to, and to start something new that we've never done before is a brand new position, and it's hard to switch, but we're getting there. And my goal really is to connect and collaborate with and develop relationships with a lot of the mandatory partners under WIOA, which includes, of course, like the American Job Centers, which I won't go into detail with, but they are an important partner that I'm much more connected to now than I've ever been before. But also with the partners in California, and in my mind, who is best going to be able to help me, help my staff, help our consumers, which are about 5,000 of them we serve each year, get the best jobs possible to live in this expensive state. And, you know, I know a lot of us don't want to leave California. I know people do because they have to, but I'd rather allow them to live here, make a livable wage, and buy a home if possible when the rates come down, and, you know, raise a family if they want to. And then after, you know, you work with the benefits and the time and energy you put in, do things like Ralph Black and Dr. Campisi, who I saw yesterday, go to some of the same places I've been, but a bunch of others that I'd love to go to, and enjoy that. I mean, that's part of this too. And the Department of Rehab's, you know, logo says employment, independence, equality. That's really what it comes down to. We're about employment. I know you all know the WIOA, you know, Sunshine, the Homemaker cases in 2016. That wasn't our, you know, call. That was the federal government, and they emphasized students. We have to spend a 15% of our entire budget on those students, 16 to 21, which personally I agree with, because that is the future and of what we're trying to do to change people's lives. I'm not saying the other things aren't important, you know, in retirement, but to me, it's all connected. And I know a lot of you are here and you heard about 2480. And how we can maybe replace some of those things for some of our older blind, that obviously we're in favor of that too, but we're following the federal government's rules. And my own personal interest is employment, but also these other things are important too. So I know a lot of the people that I need to connect with in the state. It's nice to hear today, Sharon. I look forward to meeting you. Laura and I are going to go on a road trip soon to reconnect after COVID, which was really threw everybody for a loop. I don't need to remind everybody about that, but what is this? The first time you've met in 3 years? Yeah. So it's the first time I've, you know, been on the road in 3 years. A lot of staff have changed. A lot of the new directors like Sharon are new. You know, it's nice to hear Julie here. I know Steve and Silvana are here. They're partners with the Cal ATSD assistive technology. That's a huge part of, you know, what we deal with. And all these relationships, the better, you know, those are, sometimes they take in person like this to reestablish those. I'm sick of Zoom, and no offense, Nancy, but and having to be on the computer all day long. And there's a dynamic that happens when you're in a group of people, even if you can't see, I know you know this because you're here, you know, that's different than when you're just on a, yeah, on a screen and or on a phone. So I, you know, my goal, you know, ever since I was 18, I was in a motorcycle accident when I was 18, and my career was set. I was going to be a naval, you know, pilot. I had already been accepted, and then bang, right before graduation, I was in this accident. It's like, what am I going to do? And I think about that all the time, because one thing I've learned as I've gotten older is how much not easier it was for me, but my life, I had a lot of support. I grew up in a pretty well-to-do family. Dad was a surgeon, six boys, and in a nice area, good schools, all that. I realized how many of our consumers just do not fit that mold, and how much I was blessed for what I had and the support I had and the jobs I had when I was a teenager. I talked to Joe all about this, you know, over the years. I learned to love work when I was a kid. My grandfather taught me how to mow yards and stuff. So, and I thought, wow, money's nice, you know, you can buy all this candy and stuff. So, and then it goes on, it goes up from there. And so I was thinking, how am I going to work? Who's ever going to marry me? How am I going to buy a house? You know, and I want everybody who's blind to still have that dream. And it's not going to be with a minimum wage job. I look at the other states and things across the country, and their, you know, their what their average wages are for placements. And Joe and Sue know what I'm talking about. And when I look at, you know, minimum wage, which is a lot lower in those other states than it is here, compared to, you know, $28 an hour for BFS, I think we're either at the top or close to it in the entire country of any district anywhere in terms of how much money we're giving, you know, to our people to get where they need to go to live a rewarding life. And otherwise, yeah, I'll just be like, I'll sit home and just collect my benefits and listen to music or something. But I didn't want to do that. I don't want that. I want more. And I want our consumers to want more. And, you know, Joe to me is very inspirational. He didn't have it as easy as I did. He always tells me I'm just this little farm boy from some county down who knows where in San Joaquin or something. And I said, yeah, just a little farm boy, Joe. Okay. So, but he did. He didn't have it that very easy. And I watched Sue and I saw her in the hallway and how good she was and driven and organized and a mom and, you know, a wife. And just like, I said, Sue, you might want to check out OCB. They got that. You'd just be really great. And look at her go, you know, she's inspirational to me and everything she did growing up. And Laura, too. That's why I hired Laura. Laura grew up in a visually impaired world that I never had to deal with. You know, I was just like a dumb jock, you know, playing basketball and stuff and track and everything was going my way. And so I always have to keep that in mind. I try to. I don't think there's a more responsible job than a counselor, you know, in this field. I really don't. I worked for a big law firm and I had all these huge multi-million dollar clients. I just never dealt with any humans. It just all millions of dollars everywhere. I never felt like I was really contributing to really much of anything other than just a bunch of legal briefs and things. And I just, so when I switched, I went into this field, I realized the power that somebody can have. And when I see somebody not prepared or able to do that as a counselor with their consumer and have the knowledge and expertise they need to know, or at least even the interest, you know, like what can I do to help this person out? It really bothers me. And I was just having dinner last night with one of our managers. She's got the first person she's been able to hire as a counselor in like 15 years as a manager. I couldn't believe that. But this person has you know, been in rehab 15 years, but they don't know anything about BFS. And I was very impressed with what she had that person go through in the last month and what she thought they had to know in order to be a productive, good counselor. Yeah, I saw Ed Cressman. Anybody know Ed here? Yeah. Oh. You know, one thing I love about Ed is Ed, you know, ever say, oh, he asks so many questions. Yeah, he does. But you know, they're interesting, good questions. He pushes me to be a better leader. He challenges me. And although, you know, I feel like I'm a little bit of a boxing max sometimes. I like it. I'm competitive too. It's like, okay, what do I need to know? But Ed, I will say one thing about Ed. After all these years, he's like a young kid still in terms of his advocacy for his consumers. And I give Ed a lot of credit for that. And because I know he's looking out for his consumers, whether they're a kid in high school or older. And I give you a lot of credit, Ed, for that all these years. And I know I keep hearing whispers of a retirement stuff, but I know Ed probably doesn't really want to retire. I know. And because he loves what he does for a good reason. He's changing people's lives. My first counselor was terrible. I hated that guy. So, and he was ready to retire. He was so dang grumpy. He didn't ask me anything. And he just, what do you want to do? And here he's a talking calculator. Go to statistics. Like, you said you wanted to go into business. So really? You know, you need people who understand or need to have an interest as to what you how to get to where you need to go. And so that's my job. And Laura, Sue, Joe have been extremely supportive of me and flexible. That's one thing that shocked me about state government is there's a lot of flexibility as long as you stay within the rules in terms of trying to, you know, get where you need to go. And that's what made this job good. I have got a slow start in this new position, but I look forward to gathering momentum and trying to get the resources through the various CRPs out there I mentioned and the AT and everything else to make it better for the Californians who are blind and visually impaired, get to a place where they feel like they're part of society on an equal playing field and have those lives, like I mentioned, with the house and the family and everything else, if that's what they want, to live a fulfilling life. You know, that's not just some low level thing. And so I'll leave it at that. I look forward to having more discussions with you all in the future on my road trip. Sharon, we're coming to see you. And nice to hear Julie here. Nellie has been a fabulous advocate as well over all of her years. Nice to hear your voice, Nellie. So we're all here, I think, for the same reason. Who else? Trish is here too. Hey, Trish. Yeah, another one of my superstar managers there. She's always been right up there, too. I'm realizing all the people here feel the same way I do. I know. So I'm going to let the next person speak before we open it up, because I'm curious to hear what she has to say, because we wanted somebody on this panel when Sarah talked to us that, you know, like we had at SB 105 a few years ago. Tell us from a business perspective, you know, who are they hiring and why? What do you need to get hired? And I've heard some things in the past when we've had some job placement people for blind only. We've sent them, we say, yeah, they're ready to go. And then we get this feedback. No, they're not ready. So let's hear from her in terms of what it takes to be ready. And then we'll have questions and answers, if I remember that right, Sarah, for our panel today. And I wanted to thank you all for your commitment to what we're all trying to do. And I appreciate you all and being here, and keep up the great work. Do I pass this to the project?
Okay, great. Thank you. My name is Jamie Gibson Barrows, and I am a proud employee of Valley Center for the Blind in the Central Valley. Ooh, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. We cover the basically Madera all the way up to Kern. So our service area is Madera, Fresno, Tulare, Visalia, Kings, and Kern County. So all of our clients are within those markets, and then everything around it in the rural areas, you know, east and west as well. So we are a CRP, we're DOR, and we've been around, well, we're just, our 50th year anniversary is this year. And it has evolved from the day that it started into where it is today. And I'm just going to kind of focus on the last 3 years. Not that I should just miss anything prior to that, but our primary jobs were training, independent living, Braille, AT, O&M, and ILS, which is independent living skills, and getting people trained and ready to go to work. And we did that for quite a few years, but then we found that we are spending all of this time with our clients, and we're finding that they're not, once we're done with them, they weren't being very successful getting jobs when we thought that they were ready, or at least they were trained enough technology-wise, independence to go out there and be able to obtain a job and retain it. So once we found that it wasn't, and working with the Department of Rehab, then we started offering employment services through our office. My position there is the employment specialist. We started working on this project and placing people in 2019. So we've just about had a 3-year practice on this. So let me go back a little bit. So the employment services, in order to ensure that they're actually ready, the first thing we do is what's called an intake. The intake allows us to have those conversations, see where they are, and are they truly ready to go to work? You know, have they addressed barriers that perhaps that was missed, or they didn't share with any of their instructors or their DOR counselor? Those types of things. Then we're going to go ahead and then we're going to do our prep. And then if they're job ready, then we're going to go through the prep phase of it. And that includes resume building, advocacy for accommodations, a lot of role playing for interviewing. Okay. Because a lot of people who have worked, you know, they have interviewing skills, but they don't have interviewing skills as a person of who is blind now. Because some of them were working as fully sighted, and then now their world is different. So being able to address that. And then a big thing for us is the benefits counseling. And we work with the Department of Rehab on referrals to the work incentive planners. And we give them the basic information, because that's one of the biggest fears for individuals with all disabilities that are on Social Security or Social Security disability, that I can't work because I'm going to lose everything. I'm going to lose what I'm used to. And I'm like, you could get along with that $600 check? Really? Don't you want more? You know, so it's a myth. So they work partner, and once they're educated, and it takes, you know, one client at a time, and, you know, they get buy-in and they have that education and that understanding with the WIP counselors and the basic information we provide. And then that fear goes away. Then once we get through the prep, we go to the job development phase, and that's resume and enhancing their resumes and the jobs that they're applying for. And then once we get them placed, then we go through a job retention, and I stay in communications with them once they are placed, and that includes short-term support. If I have to go out there and help advocate for them, ask for accommodations, talk to their HR, anything that I need to do to help and assist this individual to maintain and get this job, we're going to do that. But before we get there, a lot of times we will do what's called a vocational assessment. And we will do that prior to our intake. And that helps us and Department of Rehab uncover, you know, what are their qualities? What are they capable of doing? Because again, like they were saying earlier, a lot of individuals have never worked before, or they worked and then they lost their sight and they haven't worked for 15 years. And then going through, you know, those phases of vocational, we have situational assessments that we help with to DOR. So we do have clients who have multiple disabilities. And what are their abilities? What are they capable of? What can they do? And we work together and uncover those so we can make recommendations to the DOR counselors on what might be the best ways, areas for them to work. And then, of course, we have our professional communications. And all of those together helps us get into the actual placement and getting ready for work. The other thing that we've also added, just like they were mentioning earlier, is adult work experience. Okay, they were talking about the student work experience and then the adult work experience. And I believe that's our newest, and I'm not sure if we hit our 1 year mark on that or not. But it's doing the same thing, is giving these individuals work experience. I have one client who was a homemaker her entire life, never worked. And we put her in an adult work experience, and now she's in a second adult work experience. And it's pretty much changed her life around and her perspective about herself, what her abilities are, and that she can work and get a sustainable job. And so she's working really hard on that as well. And let's see. Another thing that we're working on is we have developed a workforce development within our organization. And that also came out about 2019. And with that said, we are out there and getting partnerships in within our community, our local and federal government, NIB, and Ability One. Okay, so we're out there working really hard to get some of these contracts and partnerships to employ internally off of these contracts. And the last I was told, we have hired upwards to 40 individuals under these contracts we've been doing and getting agreements with. 98% of those employees are blind or low vision. So that's a very good success story that Shalina and Ray have been working on. And we've been successful with those placements internally. And primarily it has been call center type work, telework, and which has become, of course, very popular because you don't have any transportation issues, right? So so we've had that. And then as far as with the Department of Rehabilitation and working, we feel it's sad, but it's success that this year so far, since October, we've placed 11 individuals into sustainable jobs. And that seems like a small number. We've just pretty much started. However, it was zero for many, many years. So I think that we're on the right track. We have work to do. We're growing a lot. Right now, through the Department of Rehab, I have, between employment services and adult work experience, I have 44 clients that are all enrolled that I'm working with right now. So I'm going to get all of them a job, I promise. So, I think that's kind of the basics of it. I mean, there's a lot more involved into it. I don't want to take a lot of time, you know, because I want everybody to have a chance to have their Q&As. So I'm going to send it back to you, Joe.
Joe's gone.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant Laura.
Sorry, Laura.
It's okay.
I called worse. Yeah. All right. Does anybody have any questions for any of us? And the lady who had the question about ESL, Nancy's going to give her my email so I can work with her later on that. I didn't just brush her off. Okay.
Okay. So for those of you on Zoom, if you could raise your hand, anybody in the room, if you have any questions, please raise your hands and somebody will find you as well. And we'll start off on the Zoom platform. Do we have anybody with their hands raised?
We don't have any raised hands right now. No.
Okay, thank you. And you don't have to ask a question. You can make a comment. We're here to listen. Okay, is there anybody in the room that has any questions or comments? Raise your hand. There's somebody in the back. You want to? Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, this is Peter Pardini, and I have a question via my wife. What can be done to increase the speed of obtaining adaptive equipment for job employment. I mean, it seems to be currently a 5 to 6 month process, and it just that's just too long.
We agree.
And it really affects employment when you don't have the proper tools.
Yeah, we agree. Okay, we're not. We totally agree. The issue is that there's more than one issue. It's a multifaceted issue because some people need assessments, and if you need an assessment before you get to the AT, there's additional layers in there. If there's some problems with supply chains, there's issues there. We have some manpower issues right now. We are working on a few changes, kind of bucking the system for what we need to do to be able to move those things along faster. We do hear you and know that we meet regularly to try to make things better. We've already implemented some systems to move our authorizations along more quickly, but there is one component of it, which is the bid process for the state of California. And yes, we have the CalATSD website. We have a lot of these things in process, but there's still requirements for having quote has to be within 30 days. If it goes outside of 30 days, we have to get a new quote. There's seller permits. There's all these kinds of things that have to be in place before something can be actually authorized. So we do hear you. But like I said, there's more than one issue going on here because of the multiple layers that get involved with this. But if there is, and if there's something you feel like that we can do faster, better, I understand the process of the authorization might be a little out of control, but before
also getting appropriate equipment training too.
So
that's a whole nother whole process. But I mean, my wife's ready to go to work, and she just needs to get her equipment lined up, and so she can proceed with her life goals.
Right.
She happens to be.
And if you want to chat with me afterwards, I can give you my card and we can go over the specifics and see where there might be a hang up. Like,
sure, I'd love to.
I'm honest with you. Unfortunately, the process is not what it should be, not what we'd like to see. And we are working on it. Please know that we are working on it. We do know.
Yeah, I'd like to get your card and I'll pass it on to my wife.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, she's unable to be here today.
Yeah. It's just. Yeah, and we are and some of the things like training, like assistive technology training, there were some. I'm trying to encourage in our staff. We do know it's really nice to be able to train on your own equipment, but we have a lot of CRPs that have equipment that the individual can go and at least start. Because if you can start training on your own, that's a huge help as well. But not everybody has that available in their neck of the woods, kind of a thing. So, yeah. So I apologize. I know it's a problem. Anybody else have any questions?
Yes, there's one here.
My name is Hello. My name is Xiomara Diaz, and my question is in regards to when can young teenagers start the training of ILS? My son is 17 years old. And he's already enrolled in DOR, but because he's still in high school and he's getting some support from the county, they keep holding his ILS training a little bit. He might be enrolled in the summer programs, but my question is, how can I get that started for him? Because his goals are to go, he has a goal to get into the university straight and he wants to go somewhere else. He has glaucoma. And I am the parent, and he only has his grandma, which is my mom. And we're worried about that transition that he's going to have and where he's going to go. To be honest, he's not that prepared. And I don't want to stop him, you know, just keep him near me because he has very great goals there. But that's my concern.
If I understood your question, you're asking how soon can we start ILS?
Yes.
And was there a specific area of ILS you had a concern about?
Everything in relation to becoming independent in, cooking and everything.
Yeah. Okay. So I heard you mention the summer programs. A couple of CRPs have some excellent summer programs. Mm-hmm. And they are funded by DOR, but the CRPs do an amazing job of you know, starting some of those processes. Mm-hmm. And the reason I asked about ILS, because that means different things to different people. Mm-hmm. Sometimes students, you know, they don't want to learn to cook. They want to learn how to make mac and cheese and that's it. That's from my own college students' experience. The answer is anytime that we can make the services work. So again, it's a matter of communicating with the counselor what specifically you feel that individual needs as ILS. Sometimes it's a matter of working with a CRP locally, like maybe they go to classes at the CRP. Sometimes it's things like going to one of our residential programs. We have three. We have the Orientation Center for the Blind in Albany. That is run by the Department of Rehabilitation directly. That's the program that Sue used to be the administrator over. We have the Hatland. We actually have four technically now. The Hatland Center in Palo Alto, San Pablo, that does an apartment-based program. And we have Wayfinder down in the South that has an independent living program as well. So those three programs, the individual will go and live there and learn independent living skills. And sometimes it's good to take that year off or 6 months off between high school and college to get those skills. I know that kids are often anxious to go to college, but the success rate is better if they take the time to do that. But it's such an individual choice. We've also used a few out of state, but for the most part, our needs are met with those three programs in California for in terms of residential programs.
Can I at least stay, go for a couple of weeks? Could that help also?
Well, it depends on the program. Most of them are set up to be by months. OCB has a 12-week program. They start every 12 weeks. They start a new cohort. So that's probably the shortest one. But again, that would depend on the need because everybody comes in a different need. And especially a high school kid, really, you know, even kids that have full vision don't know how to necessarily know how to mop the floor. So they might not even realize they have that need. Oh. Until they go there and start talking with other people. And the other advantage, if somebody wants to do that with the residential programs, is they meet other people who are visually impaired. And that gives a huge boost of confidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in my experience, I've been receiving training for so many years, and I'm currently a client, a consumer of DOOR, and I'm through Cove, I'm receiving more trainings. I had my first job as a massage therapist, but then I had to change it because of some health issues. And now I really don't know what to do or what to do next because I cannot continue doing any massages. So I'm almost done with the basic training of what I'm doing right now through the agency and this association.
That's great.
To know what else I can. I want to get hired, you know, to the goal to get a better wage and all of that. And that's what I want to see who I can reach to get more advice. And
yes, and thank you for bringing that up. You mentioned that you were at a job that didn't work out or wasn't working for you now. We have we've always been able to do retraining, but mm-hmm. now under WIOA, we are encouraged to do advancement in employment. And that's kind of in place for maybe somebody wants to go work at a, you know, maybe they get a job as a secretary and they do that job for a couple of years and then they want to do more. You know, it's a very typical way to go. Is people start off at lower paying jobs, you know, get that work experience. And then go to other jobs. So if somebody would say they'd worked a couple years at a relatively entry-level wage job and they want to go back to school at that point, those are services we're doing now as well. So we're BFS, I've become very competitive and we do a really good job with things like, you know, the college and career kinds of things. But getting these services where people can actually start at an entry-level job, come back later to come back for advancement is really game-changing. And, you know, because we've been kind of doing it all along, that's the reason our numbers are so much better than the rest of our state in terms of incomes, because we have the opportunity to train people in a way that that gets them good jobs. And one of the things, I am digressing a bit, but one of the things one of us was going to cover was, so we've actually had people go to work as doctors. We've had that were helped through that were consumers of Blind Field Services. We've had somebody who went to work as a medical researcher. He had an MD. So we're having success at many, many levels. So, mm-hmm. Any other questions?
I have a raised hand in Zoom.
We have, I got two in the back here in the room. Whatever you want to do first.
Okay. Do you have one on Zoom?
Yes, we do. Deborah Armstrong, you may unmute. Okay.
All right. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. I have not been a DOR client since the 1970s, so my rehab knowledge is deprecated. But I work at a community college, and this question is about helping my blind students. Here's the scenario. The student will typically tell me that they've taken our access technology training, which is excellent. And now they want to get their own computer and start looking for work. And the rehab counselor says, I know your dad bought you an iPad, so we don't need to buy you a computer. Well, they cannot be successful in college without having their own computer unless they want to live in our lab and do everything on our lab computers. And that's not really fostering independence or the ability to show an employer that they can use a computer. So how can my students convince their counselor that they truly need to get a Mac or a Windows computer and not just an iPad, which is not appropriate for college?
Okay, so that's a very, very specific question, and it distresses me to hear this, but would you or somebody give you my email or phone contact, and we can work this, I can figure out where the problem is and go from there?
Well, it's a trend. That's my concern, is I've seen this trend over the last 5 years, and that really concerns me. Because
right, and it may, yeah.
Community college is cheaper than university. So there should be lots of money left over since they're not paying university tuition to buy them some of this equipment. And I'll go back on mute. Thank you.
Yeah, we do not ration services. So there's not an issue of there's not enough money. Our issue is the equipment needed to get to their employment outcome. So if anybody, that's why I say, I want to talk with you offline. Maybe Nancy's on Zoom. She can give you my contact information, and I would be happy to chat with you, because it shouldn't be a trend either. And, I will confront that directly. Peter's laughing because he knows I will.
For the right reasons.
I every time I speak, I hear something like that, and I go back, assuming I can find the problem, and most of the time I can, we have a dialogue. So it is not about rationing services. So definitely, if Nancy could give her my email offline, or if you get it from Sarah can also give it to you as well, I'd be happy to talk with you. Just, say, hey, you just send me an email saying you're the one I talked to at the conference, and we'll set up a time to talk.
Well, my email is public because I work for the state, so I can give it here if you want.
Well, it would just be.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'll be honest with you. If it winds up written down here, it might go away. So I don't have any electronic thing to have with. But yeah, Nancy can give it to you. And again, just quickly say we're the person. So
yeah, type it in the message.
Yes, thank you. Just a quick message. Anyone? I think there was some.
Yes, this is Leslie Gibbons.
Hi, Leslie.
Hi. For those of you that don't know me, I'm a provider of technology. And I really want to recognize the hard work that the Blind Field Services field staff and the purchasing team do. I see them daily working so hard to process a really large number of requests for equipment. But sadly, their efforts are being severely hampered by one or two others who insist on adhering to rules and regulations at the expense of common sense, effectiveness, or efficiency. And my comment would be, perhaps we should ask those people to do their jobs without their equipment, and maybe that would encourage them to see their responsibilities slightly differently.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you, Leslie.
We have another one in the back.
I just wanted to give a resource for the people who are waiting or need a computer. Computers for the Blind, formerly a longtime organization. They currently have a grant program. So you can get a fully equipped laptop for $50 with all of the adaptive technology on it that you need, JAWS, Fusion, everything on it that you need for $50. If it's certified by one of the agencies or by DOR, there's no other paperwork to go through, and you can get that relatively quick. So it's computersfortheblind.org. They're a partner organization. I've worked with them for a long time. In fact, I got my first computer as a blind person from them. So just a resource that's great, and a $50 laptop. And these are great laptops. They've been all refurbished and have all of the software on it. So, and thank you for your presentation.
Do you want to say something? Peter wants to say something. Here you go. You can just talk.
Where is it? Oh,
to your right.
Just talk. It's right behind
you. Oh.
There you go.
Yes.
Yeah, I know we're going to wrap it up now, and I appreciate it. And I just wanted to say one thing with a comment somebody just mentioned about rationing services, and a story Ed told me last night, which disappointed me. About a decision that was made, and that the reason they did not bring it to appeal it to the manager, Ed's manager, was because the fear of retaliation or other repercussions. I've heard that a lot over the years. And if that ever happens, you can always call Laura or me to staff it if you want. But remember, there's the client assistance program through DRC still. And they're really good, you know, at what they do. And they'll keep your, you know, anonymity, if that's what you're asked for, at least in the beginning. And you can run it by them and see, like, am I out of bounds here or not? So just remember that. And because I still hear these stories, which is kind of amazing. Today I've heard two in the last 24 hours. It's like, really? So I don't like hearing that. Everybody should be treated fairly and honestly. And if they can't advocate for themselves as well as Ed does, or I do for myself, you know, not everybody's got that kind of personality or support system to push stuff for something. So remember that. And if you need a second opinion or an objective, you want to talk to somebody and you're worried about the manager, go to Laura and then, or me, and we'll talk it out and see if we can work something out. And DRC too. I think they've been very fair, and they're neutral, but they're really there for the consumers, not for us. Mm-hmm. So thank you all. Laura or anybody else, Sarah, how do you want to wrap this up before everybody takes off for lunch?
Sarah doesn't have a mic, so I'll yell for her.
All right, Jamie.
Thank you guys for joining us today. Remember, DOR does have a booth out if you have any questions and want to speak to them directly. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your day and join us at the next meeting. Have an awesome day, guys. Thank you.